Hey, this is Mad Beef, the Australian Rollerblading Podcast. I'm Mikey Lynch, and finally I get around to doing an interview episode with Tassie vert legend Shane Yost. It seems crazy that it's taken this long for us to get around to talking together, but after some conversations back and forth on Instagram about how much we love hand plants and things like that, and he was sharing sort of the process of, you know, some of the tricks that came more naturally to him, the process of familiarizing himself with tricks after a, you know, hard fall and injury. I don't know, it just kind of came up to sort of say, hey, let's get around to doing it. So I hope you enjoy. Hey, thanks heaps for your time.
Hey, no troubles at all, man. It's a pleasure. It's always nice to meet a fellow Tassie skater.
Yeah, you bet. Did you get on the ramp today?
I didn't end up getting on. Kind of felt a bit tired this morning because had a bit of a big day yesterday. And then I'm so kind of managing my energy levels at the moment because I've got a big race. I've got a big Buffalo Stampede race that I'm doing tomorrow.
What is Buffalo Stampede?
Okay, so Buffalo Stampede is it's named after the mountain. So one of the closest mountains to where I live. I live about 10 minutes away from Bright, in between Bright and Myrtleford, so way up in the country, which is around about 4 hours from Melbourne. So the closest mountain to us is Mount Buffalo, which is not a massive mountain. It's probably around 1,800 metres, probably less than that, probably around sort of 1,500 metres or so. And, every year they do the Buffalo Stampede, and there's a variety of distances from 10 to 20 to 42 to the big 100K. My 100K event. So, yeah, it's a bit of a monster.
What are you doing?
Doing the 42 tomorrow.
Okay, marathon. You ripper.
Yeah, it's a real fun one because you actually start on Mount Buffalo itself and you run your way down into your Robin Creek, and then from there, this is going to make no sense to you at all, but it's all good. Then you go across over to the Buckland. From the Buckland, you go to Dingo Ridge up to Clear Spot, which is basically one of the high sort of big hills behind Bright, and then you descend your way down into town and finish in town. So it's kind of cool, and it's got a real European vibe to it. They ring cowbells at the different points, and it's got a really cool atmosphere to it as well. So it's a real fun marathon as opposed to just going and pounding the pavement.
What's your hoped, like, what would you be happy with in terms of time?
Oh, look, in the past, I've done just under 6 hours. Look, my fitness and conditioning at the moment's not really super great. So, look, anywhere under 7 hours, and I'll be pretty happy.
Sure. So it's about heavy duty run, this one, I imagine, compared to a flatter road run marathon.
So, yeah, look, it's more, yeah, you got a lot more terrain, you got single track, you've also got fire trail, and you're looking at around about 1,800 metres of elevation with about 2,500 metres of de-elevate or, you know, descending. So, yeah, it's quite hilly.
Gosh, those knees, they're going to be talking to you on Sunday, aren't they? Yeah, I'm in Hobart, and so I've done the Point to Pinnacle both. I've run it once and walked it a couple of times. And I mean, that's, I guess, an equivalent thing just going up, though, where it's like a half marathon, but it's feels a lot more than just a half marathon because you're making so much elevation to get to the top of Mount Wellington from Rest Point.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Yeah, I've done a couple of I've been down to Hobart back when I was in the fitness industry and I was doing stuff for Iron Edge, and there was a couple of gyms that I did some workshops at, and whilst I was down there, I did a couple of runs, not all the way from, obviously not from sea level, but did some climbs up Mount Wellington, and it's so much fun. It's such good terrain. Yeah. And then a buddy of mine lives, I forget where he lives, but we've done a couple of runs. And he's taken me out the back behind Mount Wellington to some really cool little trails and stuff as well. And yeah, I love trail running. It's so much fun.
Sweet. All right, let's talk about skating though. That's why we're here. Unless we're going to talk about pneumatic tire rollerblades.
Nice. Yeah. Look. Yeah. If I wander off track, I've got a real tendency to just go off on weird tangents. So, you know, don't be afraid to just rein me in, because as I just did then, I could just wander off and start talking about just about anything.
I don't know whether you listen to many podcasts, but I think there's a kind of, like this one has often been longer episodes, and I think there's something kind of fun about just hanging out with people, chatting, shooting the breeze, and, you know, they touch on something you're interested in, but they also just give you random bits and pieces, and it feels like you're kind of hanging out with people, like on a long drive or a run or something. So I think a little bit of those tangents is kind of fun.
Yeah, and look, at the end of the day, it's about the conversation as opposed to an interview where you've got a set amount of questions and stuff that you're trying to tick off, and and it can sound quite, you know, you can really tell the authenticity of a podcast on, you know, how the questions are going and how they're trying to, you know, direct the conversation and stuff like that. And look, the long form, I'm a big fan of the old Rogan Experience, you know, the Joe Rogan podcast. And, you know, he's a prime example of just conversation. And just no agenda, just talking about whatever. And, it's the best way to go.
Sweet. All right. Well, like I said on the Messenger, Instagram Messenger, it is always good to do a little bit of the origin story thing. And I think particularly one of the cool things, I think you might be one of the few Tassie skaters, it's definitely like in terms of someone who hit the – you know, done like the X Games, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think you're the one and the only, maybe. And it's just really cool when you hear, when the locals hear the local boy talk about local spots as a part of that story too. Do you know what I mean? So we don't need to hit absolutely everything from go to woe, but, I mean, if you can paint a little bit of a picture of how do you go from being, a Lonnie boy who has some skates and mucks around a bit to suddenly going, you know what, this is something I could really take a long way. What was that all like? Tell us a bit of your background.
Yeah, look, it's a real surreal, you know, well, like, you know, my age now, it's like it feels like somebody else's memories, which is kind of bizarre, you know, having a different, you know, path and all that sort of stuff. But look, my dad will remind me at every stage that, you know, where I came from, you know, I think it's more to make sure that my head doesn't get too big and, you know, I outgrow my personality, you know, or something like that. But look, the early days, I love the fact that I grew up in Tassie. It was awesome. I had a bit of a strange youth. I won't go into too much detail. It's a bit of a misfit anyway, but I traveled around a lot. So just to put things into perspective, my parents split when I was very young, and then my mum remarried, and then with her second husband, we moved around a lot. So in between my year one and year five, I moved six times in between, backwards and forwards, from Melbourne to Tassie, all over the place. I was originally born in Tassie, then moved around a lot, and then it wasn't until basically the end of grade five where things, mum split again, and I ended up going to move and live with my dad at that point. And then that's when things got a little bit more stable. So really you could say that set up or set the stage for the mad amount of traveling that I would end up doing later on in life. Anyway, I'm getting off track a bit, but where I started was basically, it was around about 94, 95, and it was at the end of, I would say, year nine, where I started seeing inline skates sort of popping up all over the place. And I was a little bit strange in the fact that I tended to steer away from the things that were popular and try to navigate towards the things that weren't quite so popular. Just, I don't know why I used to do that. It was just a thing that I used to do. So that being said, we used to go to the roller rink a lot. So we used to skate with my friends. We used to go round and round in circles, having a bunch of fun. Anyway, a couple of my buddies got some inline skates, and I was thinking, you know, this is not a bad idea. I guess you can skate outside, because up until that point, I never even thought that you could actually just skate outside. I always thought it was just something you did inside in a rink, going around in circles. So that being said, I'm like, well, I'm not going to do what you guys are doing. I'm going to get myself a pair of roller skates. So that was the plan until my buddy said, hey, why don't you just try these on, these inline skates? And I'm like, all right. So I tried these on over at his place, and this was when I was living in Riverside. So, yes, Lonnie boy. I went over to his place, tried these skates on, and I literally didn't take them off for about an hour. I just rolled backwards and forwards on his porch, which was just a concrete flat porch. You're looking at about 2 meters by about 5 meters. And, yeah, man, I just played around on that for about an hour, and I'm like, you know what? I think there's something to this. Then I took them onto the just out the front, like onto the street, and, you know, not doing any mad skills because I had no mad skills at that stage. But I just go off the footpath, go onto the road, roll around, and just I just, man, there's something about it. I'm just like, you know what? This is actually kind of cool. So I saved all my money up because back then, you know, I did what everyone else did, and you basically save your cash up until, you know, you like your birthdays and your Christmases, and you try and combine presents. You do the deal with your parents to try and combine presents, you know, so you can get a little bit more out of whether it's your birthday or your Christmas.
Yep.
At this point, it was my birthday. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to pull all my cash. And I got myself a set of inline tornadoes of all things. Have you ever heard of those skates?
No, man, I haven't.
No, man, because
they sound like great quality. They sound like really good quality.
They were like Malibus. Like, if you want to cast your mind back to when Malibus graced the Kmart shelves, we're basically talking about that kind of skate. So anyway, so got myself a set of these inline tornadoes, and I thought these were the greatest things in the world. And then I literally, a couple of buddies of mine at school were skateboarders, and I'd go and hang out with them after school. So we'd finish school, I'd bring my skates, and we'd just putt around the school, you know, just jumping off curbs and, you know, just doing little things and just playing about. And basically I skated those skates until they broke, until I broke the frames on them. And then my dad mended them. The bearings died, so he was a mechanic, so he basically got some bearings from work, and we refurbed the skates as best we could, until such time as the actual frame completely broke apart. And then I was like, oh, well, I guess that's kind of the end of that then. Well, funnily enough, at that point, I was kind of getting my skate legs under me. And then another buddy of mine was selling some rollerblade metros. Now, do you remember those skates at all?
Yeah, look, I mean, we kind of overlapped in terms of when I checked out and checked back in and stuff, because I started skating in the very early 90s, and I think I was checking out around the time of, like, I don't know, like it was still like Chris Edwards, like Tarmax and things so were the metros, I mean, were they like more the rec skate at that kind of time? Is that what they were?
Yeah. Pretty much. They were basically rollerblades' answer to, like, the urban rec skate.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had the sneakers. So they had the sneakers in them. So they had these little shoes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they slipped into the skate and you did them up. They were very, very loose, but I basically utilized those as best I could as skating around the place. And then out of nowhere, this was the crazy, I'm like, really, I can't do a lot with these. I can't afford anything else. And out of nowhere, my mum's partner at the time basically randomly just bought me a set of Bowers, just out of nowhere. He just dropped these skates on my lap. He obviously saw I was kind of struggling because I loved to skate, but I couldn't afford skates, and these things were the only thing I had. And I was, you know, I was just kind of wasn't really getting anywhere with them because they were just weren't, I was doing trying to do things that they were just weren't designed for. So in the end, he just dropped these things on my lap, and I was just like, what? And that changed everything. From there, I had a decent set of skates under my feet. I was then introduced to this thing called half pipe, which I was like, what? A guy called Brent Matern at school said, hey, man, have you ever tried half pipe? And I'm like, what? What is this thing, this mystical thing that you're calling the half pipe? Anyway, he said, all right, I'll take you down there. And so I went down and, yeah, just basically putted around the bottom. And the half pipe I'm talking about.
Where are we? Where are we talking here?
This is down in Royal Park, down in Launceston at the famed Royal Park.
Like the concrete cement, half pipe?
Concrete. You could almost call it a vert ramp because there's probably about an inch of vert on it, but really there's not much more than that.
No. And but it is a big mini. It's not really quite right to call it a mini either, is it? It's that weird in between.
Look, it's 9 foot. Like, for those days, it was pretty – for me at that point, it was big. But really, like, for the time, it was pretty amazing. And at that time, you only had – you had the 9 foot cement – ramp, and then next to it you had like a quarter pipe that they put upside down for some reason. I know that sounds weird, but it just meant that the transition going into it was quite sharp and the top of it was mellow, which is kind of weird to describe. But We barely touched that. We just played around on the half pipe. But that was pretty much the end of everything then, because once I got introduced to this thing called half pipe, that was it. That's all I wanted to ride. We used to ride everything else, because if you solely rode Royal Park, which is a cement, let's call it, it is a vert ramp, it's 9 foot, it's not very wide, and then imagine the worst concrete imaginable that was more that you could describe more like a cheese grater boarded the outside of it. So instead of having like pine bark or dirt or anything on the sides of Royal Park, you basically have this super rough death concrete.
Like on a highway road, that kind of concrete, right?
Worse, man. Like, yeah. Worse. Like, yeah. Deliberately roughed up to make it look good. So they were really after an aesthetic. But we always used to think if we just smoothed it out, it'd actually, you could just add to the ramp itself. So, all right, the ramp's only about 12 foot wide, so doesn't leave you a lot of room for error. So if you make a mistake, you're off onto the rough stuff. And let me tell you, the carnage that rough stuff caused to people, to skates, to equipment, and to skin and all those kinds of bits, wasn't great. So the funny thing was, is I attribute a lot of my success to riding that ramp, because you learnt to land stuff. Because if you didn't, one, it's concrete, so you got worked. The second was you ruined equipment. So if I wasn't watching what I was doing and I crashed too many times, I could literally go through a buckle like in a session on that ramp. Yeah. So it meant, you know, you're going through equipment, you're basically duct taping ice cream lid to the front of your skate to cover up the holes because of the concrete, because you know your knee slide. Well, your toes tend to drag, and that's a whole other story that I could talk about. But you'd have to makeshift repair your skates because the ramp was that bad. So really, we skated everything because you had to, because longevity on skating Royal Park all the time was like at an all-time low. You just were in trouble. So we'd ride that. We'd ride around the streets, we'd do rails, we'd do all kinds of stuff. We'd hill bomb because, let's face it, if you live in Tassie, there's hills everywhere. Yeah, and right. I lived up the back of Trevallon up in Riverside, so hill bombing into town was the greatest thing in the world, but always coming home was always a bit rough. But, it was – so at that point, this is sort of going into end of year 10, year 11, and I was skating a lot the summer holidays. I just literally ride every day. At that point, I realized, well, what's the best way to get really, really good? Well, you want to be one with your skates, is what I thought. You want to be having your skates as a literal part of your body. So I would spend the entire day inside the house, up and downstairs, you know, down to the ramp, into shops, everywhere on skate. The only time I wouldn't wear them was sleeping, but every other time I would literally wear the skates just so I could be comfortable in skates.
Yep.
And that's what we used to do. We used to do as a crew was just wear skates 24/7, just about, ride the entire summertime. And because I was doing that, I got really good kind of fast.
Mainly at Royal Park, or were you going to other places in terms of like the ramp skating?
Yeah, I got introduced to Summerhill. You may have heard of Summerhill. Have you ever heard of the Tassie guys talk about Summerhill halfpipe?
Not that I remember, no.
Yeah, it was famed as being 13 foot. I don't reckon it was 13 foot, you know, in hindsight, but it was definitely the biggest thing in the state at that time. So let's just call it 13 foot, whether it was or not, but it's, you know, just for mythological sake. It was oververt because it was in disrepair and the ply sheeting was starting to go. So we would go up there, risk the splinters to try the bigger tricks that we wanted to try, but you had the risk of needing, you know, having splinters surgically removed. I had friends that had to. They'd have to go to hospital to remove splinters. So, yeah, there was always that risk of riding Summerhill. The other thing that we used to do was ride Burnie. Burnie, surprisingly, they built a replica of the old Paran ramp in a paddock in, I think it was West Burnie or something like that.
Yeah, right.
And, yeah, we'd do car trips. We'd literally jump in the car on Saturday once we got our licenses and everyone started to drive, and we'd take off and head up there and skate Burnie. So other than Royal Park and Summerhill, we'd go to Burnie or we'd trip down to Rosny, down to Hobart.
And that wasn't the Rosny Skate Park that got built so 10 years ago. This was there was two ramps back then, right? There was a dirt ramp and then a small mini ramp. Was there even a third as well? Was it just the two?
Yeah, it was about
a really tiny one.
And it had about half a foot of vert. So that would just kind of put things into perspective on how bad it was. There was no point to have that little one. The middle one was not too bad. It was a okay mini ramp. And then, of course, the vert ramp, which was a good 11, 12 foot. It was only about 12 foot wide, or 10 to 12 foot wide. So it wasn't that wide, but it was a good ramp to ride. Over that period, so I sort of jumped ahead a little bit there, but over that period, I got kind of really good, and then I got invited to have a skate with the Coca-Cola Island Bladers, a group of guys. Just pause on
that. What's that like? Was there a cohort of people also getting to a next level in terms of skating, or were you an outlier in terms of skating?
Because
that's an interesting thing, right? Like how you develop, because there's some people who skate for years and years and years and years and years and stay at an intermediate level. And there are others who, because of a group they're in, they kind of push one another. And then sometimes it's just an individual who just kind of has the special sauce. What was your thing on that? Was it a crew that kind of pushed ahead, or was it just you found some secret power?
No, it was definitely the crew. So there was a guy called Dan, a guy called Bastic, and us three were just riding. We rode the summers. We rode through the summers. We'd rode through school. So moving into year 11 now, there was lots of free periods. And whenever we weren't in school, we were basically down the half pipe, down the skate park, just riding. So the three of us just were vibing, sessioning, skating all the time. And then, everybody knew about the Coca-Cola, the Coke team, the Coca-Cola Island Bladers. Nick Legg, Jordan Greer, Ben Hingston, Dan Elmore, I think Ben Ingman was a part of that as well, and I think Tim Moroney was the other guy. So there was six crew there that were like the bee's knees of Tassie skating at that point in time. Yeah, 100%. They'd do launch ramp shows. They would do rail shows. They would do half pipe shows, all that kind of stuff. Those were the guys. So naturally, as a Grommy and as Grommies, we all aspired to be a part of the Coke team, but, we never thought we were any good. So we were just riding until such point as we started riding with those guys. So they'd come down the ramp, and especially Nick Legg, Dan Elmore, Geordie, Pete Chandler. Can't forget Pete. Good old Pete Repeat. He'd come down as well. So we started sessioning with those guys, and we were just like, man, these guys are pretty awesome. And they just, whenever you session, somebody does a trick, you want to do a trick, everybody does tricks together, you know what I mean? And you just vibe off each other. You start trying stuff. You start trying things you wouldn't think of trying. And sooner or later, just the group level just brings everybody's level that much higher.
Yeah.
So it just accelerates. So I wouldn't say there was any special sauce. It was just everybody was riding together. Everyone was having good sessions. We'd even have the bike riders. Because at the end of the day, the crew wasn't super big. The scene wasn't that massive in Tassie anyway. So everybody rode together. Whether you're a bike rider, whether you're a skateboarder, whether you're an inline skater, nobody cared because we just sessioned together. Because of that, the vibe was great. We had awesome sessions. And I got out of the blue, I just got an invite from one of the guys saying, hey, we're having a bit of a skate. The Coke team's having a bit of a skate. Do you want to come along and have a bit of a session with us on the Coke ramp? And I'm like, oh, the Coke ramp? Oh, that's got mythological status at this point. Yeah, man, I'll have a crack. And it was stored over at Nick Legg's place of work, which was over in Invermay, and he worked for an upholstery joint, and they have a big car park out the back that they could lock up, and that's where they had the Coke ramp set up. And, I started riding, started sessioning, and they were like, do you want to be part of the team? And I'm like, oh, do you think I'm good enough? And they're like, yeah, man, you ride pretty good. And I was like, okay, yeah, man, that'd be awesome. And I was just peaking at that point because I thought, you know, this was the greatest thing in the world. And then from there, it just kind of started growing.
Was this like a all equals crew, or was it like a team leader who was the kind of the shop owner or the business, the sponsor who kind of kept you guys, held it all together? Had that, what was the kind of hierarchy of it?
Yeah, so Jordan Greer's dad, Rob Greer, was kind of like the team manager. He kind of looked after the crew and looked after the logistics and all that sort of stuff. So he was like the head honcho. He wasn't a skater. He was just Jordan's dad. Awesome bloke, just amazing. And he ran everything. And then within the group, Nick was kind of like, he was like the top dog. He was the big boy, guy that could go the highest, had the burliest tricks, that kind of stuff. But look, most of the guys were pretty even level, but Nick was kind of like that. He, if there was ever a guy that rode like Chris Edwards, it was Nick. He just, it was almost like a from a style point of view and a trick point of view, you could almost, like, it was hard to split hairs between those two styles, between Chris Edwards and Nick. So for me, it was like, you know, I kind of got to a point and I'm like, it wasn't a said thing or anything. And I'm like, I just kind of looked and I thought, okay, he's like the guy. So I just kind of just pitted myself against Nick with this quiet competition, you know what I mean? So, I just try and outdo Nick. You know, that was what I used to try and do. He's going to laugh at that if he hears this. But we had it like we were really great friends and we still are. Like, we still talk to each other. Yeah. He lives down in Hobart. And, you know, we'd skate together and we became really, really close friends. And we'd ride together, we'd session together, but there was always this unspoken competition between us two. You know, whether he was trying to go higher than I was, or I was trying to go higher than he was, he was trying to outspin me, or I was trying to outspin him. Like, in my mind, he was always that much better. So I always had something to chase. So I just always had that in my mind that, all right,
okay,
I just want to
try. A couple of questions on that then. Just super quickly. So if you're saying he's Chris, was there someone that you most kind of felt your skating emulated at that period of time?
Hang on, say that again.
So you're saying that Nick rode like Chris Edwards. Was there someone similarly that you kind of found yourself riding like, or was it pretty much the same? You just went, yeah,
Chris is the model. Not at that point. Like, I used to watch the videos and stuff, but I never really identified. It wasn't until later that I started to identify with specific skaters from the international scene. And look, I used to have long hair as well. And then people kind of started to draw a parallel between me and a guy called Renee Holgren. And I'm like, oh, and then I started looking into that. And then I was just, I was blown away. I was like, wow, I want to skate like that guy. And then Sessa, and reading the magazines. And of course we knew about, you know, all the guys, Tim Ward, we knew about Tom Fry, we knew about Sessa Mora, we knew about these guys, but they were like gods, you know, for us mere mortals, these were like gods. And then seeing those guys and seeing the tricks they were doing, you never thought, I'll never be that good. So you just didn't bother, you know.
At this time, are you guys saying pushing who gets the highest, how high are you airing, and rotations, how many rotations are you guys making at that kind of time you're talking about here?
720s are the most, 5 720s. I learned a McTwist because Dan Elmore said to me one day, because we were riding Summerhill Ramp, and he's like, man, you should try a McFlip. And I'm like, what's a McFlip? He's like, it's a 180 front flip. And I'm like, oh, is it kind of like a McTwist? And I'm like, he's like, yeah, kind of, except it's more 180 with that front flip. And I'm like, well, I got no idea how to do a McTwist. I got no idea at all. Sure, all right, I'll give that a go. So I had a couple of cracks at it and went pretty close, which was pretty strange. It didn't land it that day. But my idea of what the McFlip was and what the McTwist was just kind of somehow blended together and just turned into McTwist anyway. So then that became kind of my signature, was the McTwist, because people were doing backflips, they were doing their fives and sevens and stuff like that. And then I started working on this McTwist, and it was like,
and so you got a McTwist doing that on a ramp before you had like a bio flip off a jump ramp or anything like that?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I would say at that point, it was the McTwist. I had a front 540 and I think a fakie 540, few inverts and a few airs and stuff like that. It was probably my trick.
And how high was high for you guys at that stage? What was serious air for the Tassie crew?
Yeah, 5 or 6 foot was like, you know, that was kind of it.
That was
sometimes we'd, you know, push it up into the seven, you know, but really like what we were on, we weren't going super, super big. So, yeah, which was kind of funny. But, you know, for us it felt super huge, which is pretty cool. And needless to say, things progressed. Nick used to – he started trying nines, which was just outrageous. He even put some down. I just recently – I think on my Instagram I posted my latest sort of thing. I posted about sort of relearning and landing fakie nines again. And I paid homage to good old Nick because the only reason why I started doing nines was because of Nick. And I was just trying to outdo him because we, you know, so try and outdo each other all the time. But it was a long time before I really did a fakie 900 before, after he did. He was definitely well and truly the guy sort of that did that the first in Tassie. I kind of forget where I was going with that. But anyway, so
we got up to capturing the picture of that scene and being part of the Coke team. And
yeah, it was wild, man. It was really, really cool days. It was. We'd, you know, trip around the state. We'd go to these regattas. We'd go to these shows, have an awesome time. It was a really close-knit crew. There was no animosity. Yep. You know, everyone, you know, at the night time we'd hang out. We'd have drinks because, you know, everyone was pretty much 18 at that point anyway. And, you know, we're just having a good time, you know, skating, sessioning, listening to Pennywise and Offspring and, you know, all the punk music. Whenever we'd – one of the coolest things we used to do was we'd get the PA equipment because we used to hire PA equipment for our shows. We'd take the PA equipment down to Royal Park. We'd found a way to jack power from – because Royal Park in the front of – like we're near the water, it's a regatta ground. So they've got power that you can actually kind of tap into – on the power poles because, you know, as they have regatta and rides and things like that, you know, they need to have power. And we found out they actually left the power on all the time. You just couldn't get into the boxes. But if you found a way into the box, you could run an extension lead from the power box all the way over
through
to the half pipe.
Thing, out to the park,
around the wall, over to the half pipe. And then you just crank the music up with the PA system and just rock on.
Yeah, so good. Yeah.
So that was the kind of stuff that we used to do, man.
Yeah. So then from there to somewhere over the next couple of years, you're winning the X Games, right?
Yeah. That's a little ways off. I'll touch on something else. So 96 Nationals, me and Nick decided we were going to Sydney to the 96 Nationals to have a crack. That's when we got introduced to what it was like, you know, against the gods. Like us mere mortals, we'd reached our, you know, our little famous status in Tassie. You know, we'd, you know, done as best we could. We went our way. We went to Sydney. It was an amazing time. We both ended street and the street competition, which was over at Homebush, which was they'd set up. And I remember, like, man, like they brought in – it was basically inside the – it was like a netball or basketball stadium, and they brought all this equipment in and set it all up. And me and Nick were just like, what the is all of this? Like all these rails and par quarter pipes and launch ramps. And we were at that point, before we'd even seen anyone, we were like feeling like we were out of our depth. And, of course, the half-pipe competition they had over at Bondi, needless to say, not to go off on another tangent, but, you know, Nick did work better than I did. I didn't do that great on the park because I just was blown away by it. But then we also got to see, like, Tom Fry, Matt Salerno, Tim Ward, Toby Heslop, Scott Crawford, all of the guns ride, which was just – so intimidating for us Tassie boys. We had a crack, but like for me especially, it was just so intimidating because you were seeing these literal gods in front of you, and like how do you compete against that? Like that's what I thought. And then we went over to the halfpipe competition. Once again,
I imagine with the street thing, just on that, I imagine a challenge is like a full actual custom comp street setup and planning a line through that. If you've never had the chance to skate set up like that, that's almost something you haven't learned yet, right? Like how do you go, how do you actually use this space and ride through it and keep momentum and build up?
100%,
like that's something that's pretty hard to kind of learn while you're at the comp just doing warm-up.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. And you got to see that. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's a really good point because up until that time, we'd only done a couple of little comps at home, like, and really, like, lines and putting things together was something we really didn't think about. Like, you do a trick and another trick and that was pretty much it. But then you go to a contest like that and it's like, one, you're seeing – the, you know, the famous crew riding, and the second was they were doing trick to trick to trick to trick to trick to trick, filling 60-second runs, and it's like another level on top of what you thought you had to. You had this idea of the tricks that you needed to be able to do to compete with those guys, but then on top of that, to be able to do all that together in a run was like another level, you know what I mean? So that was just a mind blow. And then you're seeing that over on the halfpipe, just for us to ride with these guys, stepping on the ramp with, you know, the super dudes of the time was like impossible. You just couldn't do it. Like what? You're going to try and ride after someone's just linked fives, McTwists, 720s, 900s, backflips above your head? Like, what am I going to do? My little coping tricks and inverts and 540s and stuff? Like, it was just so intimidating. I can't say how intimidating it was. Needless to say, I think I ended up second last in that competition in the 96 Nationals. And it was like, wow, I've got a lot to look. At that point, I just thought, you know, I'll never be as good as those guys, but I'm still going to skate. Yeah. I'll still do what I'm doing. And then 97 Nationals, we did the same thing. We came over to Melbourne because it was in Melbourne that year. Things were better. You know, I ended up middle of the field that time, just missed out on the top 10 on the halfpipe. And I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. But still, like, the head dudes were just, like, that far in front of us that we just always thought, there's just no way. And then getting to know guys like Sessa and all those crew and, you know, getting to and to become friends with them was like, oh, this is pretty amazing. And then it was – at the end of that contest, I kind of realized I can't do this. If I like this skating thing and I want to do anything with it, I can't do it where I'm at. I'm actually going to have to move. And that's when things I started to think about, well, what's next? Like, do I want to do anything with skating, or is this just, you know, something, is this just a hobby? And I'm like, no, man, I love this stuff too much. What do I need to do? I need to move. And then I was in a year of electrical engineering at school, and I said to my dad, I'm like, I think I'm going to take a year off. And he's old school. He's like, no, you're not. You're finishing what you started. And I'm like, oh, okay. So that kind of threw a spanner in the works. But you have to understand, at that point, skating for me had grown. This is year one. This is just after year 12. I was really digging skating. I kind of got to a really good level where I thought I was at, where I was starting to think I might be able to take it somewhere. And I was starting to think outside, well, what do I need to do? What's my path to get to me, to where I need to be? And when he said that, I was like, nah, I'm going to find a way around this. And I did. I transferred out of what I was doing at that point and got accepted into Canberra University for graphic design. Because I kind of did all right in school. I wasn't a complete misfit. I did all right. So I had options. So that was my way out. I said, you know what? I'm not really into that. I want to go do graphic design and I'm going to go to Canberra University. And he's like, oh, I can see what you're doing. Yep, all right. You've got a path. Can see you're not really interested in electrical engineering. Yeah, okay, that's, yep, all right. And he was okay with that. For me, I was like, this isn't – that's not my plan, but, you know, that's okay. I've got my way out. So
that's your cover story.
And I got about a month in, basically to the point of uni where you're faced with, all right, if you pass this point, you've got a hex debt and you've got to continue going. And I was like, all right, if I pull out now, I won't have X debt. I won't have to pay for anything, and I can just start work. And because I'm away from home now, I'm not living under, you know, under my parents' roof anymore. I can kind of do what I want. And, from there it was just like I started working and skating. Then I moved with my girlfriend at the time down to Melbourne and worked and skated, and that was my focus. skating, working, skating, just that's all I did, just constantly for about a year. So we're talking around about what was this? This was 90. This is like end of 97, moving into 98, because 98 was when things really started to happen. So I was working full time. I was doing as many contests throughout Australia at the time, tripping all around the place, doing as much as I can because I needed competition experience. Because comps were where
any, what was kind of blow sponsors or pay sponsors, anything like that at this point?
Yeah, no paid, but I was at that point, whilst I was still in Tassie, I'd managed to pick up just a Flo Rosa's deal with a local skate shop. And you might have, back in the, I can show you a picture of the old Team Rosa's shirt, and it's a green one. Yeah, it's a horrendous colour, but it's got all the names on it. You've got the tiers.
Yeah, I remember that.
You've got all the names all the way down the list. All the way down the bottom, I think it's like Shane Y. And I remember everyone used to ask, who the hell is that guy? Who's the little name on the bottom, on the very bottom row? I can't remember who else is. I'd have to go and get the T-shirt to actually see the other names on there. But you had, you know, Cesar, Tim, Tom, like everybody, Ian Smith, all those guys' names on this shirt in more bigger letter. And, of course, my name was little tiny lettering on the bottom row. And I remember, you know, a lot of the guys would be asking, who the hell is that guy on the shirt, which was me. And I was in Tassie at that point. And I remember when I got given that shirt, and it was the, you know, one of the best things in the world, still riding Flo for Rosa's. Then when I moved to the mainland, I remember Rhonda Patton was the, basically the distributor. She kind of owned the distributorship for Rosa's.
I've got an image here that has Tom, Cesar, Tim, Toby, Josh, Ian, Josh C, Ben, Nick, Darren, Shannon, Lee, and Shane.
That's the one. There it is. That's my name.
This is like the back of a magazine with someone doing a, maybe Ian doing a McTwist on a red ramp.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that'd be it.
Yeah.
Sick. So, funnily enough, you know, I was going around all the competitions and there was a little bit of a cull going on just in terms of how many people were kind of riding for Rosa's at the time. I remember they were like, who's the Shane guy? Rhonda kind of knew who I was, but was like, oh, I think I'll get rid of him. And then Cess was like, nah, don't. Leave him on there because he's going to be doing some stuff. Like, just trust me, leave him on the team.
Yeah.
Just like, okay, if you say so. So this kind of leads into Cess is probably the sole reason to my success. Granted, you know, I did all the stuff myself, you know, to get to where I was. But if it wasn't for Cess, I would never have got the opportunity that I did. He seems to think that that's not the case, but I beg to differ, and I will be forever thankful for his involvement, because I'll go into that story on how that worked. But before I lose track of where I was up to, anyway, so this was 98. So now we're talking 98. This is when things were starting to happen. I done a bunch of contests. I think I managed to win a small contest in South Australia. Then I remember there was another contest coming up at Vertex, and I didn't have a lot of money in those days. So I literally jumped on a train the Friday night from Melbourne to Sydney, jumped on a train up to Vertex, got off the train Saturday morning, got a cab from the train station down to Tarrant Point, then did the contest, of course. This is where I learned that you can't just go and not sleep and then expect to do well at a contest, because it just doesn't work. And I actually got injured at that contest. I did a McTwist and hung up so badly that I just bashed my shins and took myself out of the contest before I had a chance to really do too much. And limped my way back to back to Melbourne. Luckily, I didn't break anything, but I, you know, it stopped me skating for about 2 weeks. Then I did a few more contests, and then the good old X Games, Planet X Games, came up on the Gold Coast. Do you ever remember seeing anything about the Planet X Games?
Yeah, I knew of it. Yeah, I was, my head was in different things at that time, but yes, I knew of it. Yeah.
Anyway, so that kind of popped up, and there was some crew that came out. Mike Budnick came out, Eitan Kramer, a bunch of other crew as well were there, and it was my chance to, you know, sort of ride against some internationals, all the guys, and man, I ended up, I don't know how, I don't know why, it was something clicked, something happened, and I managed to win that contest, which was just outrageous. So yeah. I just don't know, the planets aligned and it worked and won that contest, and I started to get some notoriety. Like, people were like, wow, okay, cool, Shane's doing well.
At that things point, started, what were your edge? What was the things that kind of made you stand out in terms of, you know, tricks, amplitude, style? Were there particular things you reckon were starting to?
Yeah, I guess, like, I was never a super big skater in terms of going super, super massive. You know, I used to do some okay sized airs, in my opinion, and stuff like that. But really, it was just trick vocabulary. At that point, I'd picked up flats, because I remember seeing Ato. He came to the NIS contest that was down in St Kilda at that time. It was, I think that was Australian titles, which I didn't do too badly at that year in 98. I think I finished middle, like fifth or something like that. Did a spectacular alley-oop McTwist swan dive, which was pretty spectacular, which I didn't make. It was funny. It was very funny. I didn't get hurt, which was awesome, but it was just, you know, just kind of ruined one of my runs, which was a bit of a bugger, but it was pretty wild because it was an accident. Didn't mean to alley-oop and just ended up upside down. Anyway, that's another story. But I saw him do flat spins and switch flat spins, and I'm like, ooh, okay. And then I started working on those. And funnily enough, I actually picked that up fairly quickly, picked up flatties, and then I just magically picked up switch flat spins. Picked up some I was doing some bigger spins at that point, so I was doing some fakie nines, some forwards nines.
How common were switch tricks, switch airs, switch spins by that point? Was that already a pretty standout kind of flex to be sort of working on not only your trick vocab, but then doing it in the reverse direction?
Yeah, it was more common. It was becoming common. I would never say it was super common, but you know, Matt Salerno and Tim Ward were real pioneers of that sort of stuff, and they were doing that, and it was pretty wild. I remember 97.
But that's opened up the way you can use the ramp, doesn't it? That's part of what it enables you to do. You can,
And it just shows that you're just quite masterful at what you know, at your art. You know, you can do a trick one way and then do the trick back the other way, which is pretty wild. I'm just trying to think, like, it's always been a hard thing to do your switch and natural variations. In my opinion, and me and Brad, do you know Brad Watson, yeah?
Yeah, a little, yeah.
Yeah, me and Brad, amazing skater. He's done some amazing, toured with me a bit in the States, great friend of mine, another one of my little sparring partners. Me and him used to battle on the ramp all the time, which was pretty cool. And I forgot the point I was going to make there. Oh, yeah, we always used to have a discussion about labeling tricks. So in terms of, if you could do a trick one way, that was your natural way. If you could do that same trick the other way, that would be switch or unnatural. And then if you could do the trick the other way but not your natural way, we used to call that opposite. So you have your three, you've got your natural, your switch, and your opposite. Mm-hmm. So then that's, so anyway, that's, you had people that were doing those kinds of things at that point, but I wouldn't say it was a thing that everyone was doing.
By opposite you mean if for whatever reason you just happen to have unlocked the trick in a way that's not normal for every other way you rotate, and so is that kind of what you mean there, where like you only have it on what would otherwise be your unnatural direction?
100%. So if I could 540 to the left, that would be my natural. My natural 540 would be to the left. However, if I 720 to the right, then, well, I can't do it natural, and it's my other direction. So that would become opposite. That would be an opposite 720.
A little bit like the way some people have random ways in which they solve versus front side grind that technically shouldn't be the way they do
totally.
It. Gotcha.
So that's how we use it.
Because then as a result, you end up turning into your soul grind on the ramp in a way that you don't turn naturally in any other turn with that kind of stuff. Yeah, gotcha.
100%. Which was kind of cool for me because I'll just – this is a weird tangent, but my invert arm is my right arm, but I turn to my left.
Okay.
Yeah. So – it allowed me to learn switch turns because I had to turn switch.
The inverts just onto, to turn your hand down. Yeah.
You got it. And soul grind is the same thing. For me, I turn to my left, but I soul to my right.
Yeah. See, I turn to my right and soul to my left. So there you go.
Perfect. Nice. So that's cool because it kind of sets you up for, if you can wrap your brain around it, it sets you up for doing tricks in that opposite direction. So then if you're going, as I said, if you can wrap your brain around it, then it's easier to start turning and spinning in different directions, which is pretty cool. So what was I talking about prior?
Oh, you're talking about winning the Planet X, and I then interrupted to say what was your edge, and you're saying it was some of these switch things and so on.
To go back on that question, it would be just trick vocabulary, just being able to do a lot of different stuff. I knew I didn't have the big, big airs that Cess could do, but I just had a heck of a trick vocabulary. And that was kind of one of the things I really went down the rabbit hole on with later on in my skating career, was just learning tricks, just doing tricks and new tricks and different stuff. So I know when I turn pro further down the track and when I say – further down the track, we're talking like 2004 to 2006-ish sort of time frame, I would have judges that would come up to me after contests and say, you know what, we only see about half of your run. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And they're like, well, you do so many damn tricks, like why don't you do some more airs and stuff so we can actually see what's going on? And I'm like, are you serious? Do you want me to do less? Less is more? Well, for me, that's just not how I – that was not – well, if I have to change the way I skate, that takes the fun out of it. So I wasn't having a bar of that, so I just learnt more tricks and made it even harder for them, which hurt me in the long term. But really, for me, it's just – that's just kind of the person I am. I rather I'll follow what it is that I enjoy about my riding, as opposed to trying to fit that skating into a box because of an agenda or, you know what I mean? Another example of that is I'm not particularly good on the coping, namely because I don't practice it enough, because I prefer to fly and flip and spin as opposed to spend time developing my balance for grinding. It doesn't mean that I hate grinding. It just means that I don't enjoy it. I love seeing the guys do crazy true spin variations and, you know, all that kind of stuff and wild. And I love watching street skating and some of the crazy stuff that people are doing now. Don't get me wrong, but for me, it just doesn't float my boat. Like, I'll do what I have to.
Is it true to say that to a certain extent, in a sense, that's in terms of what was rewarded by judging, going back to the judging, although that's not everything, like to some extent you just had to have some of that in your run, but it wasn't like you weren't going to kind of win of the competition with technicality on the coping, no matter – anyway, were you? Like you just had to have some of that in the run. Is that more or less the way it worked at the comp level?
Yeah, and there was phases of that. They really tried to make a balanced approach. They tried to redefine judging for vert a few times. Because it was quite problematic. You know, obviously, if you've got someone that's blasting 10-foot airs and doing, you know, huge spins, but only doing a few, and then you've got guys that aren't going quite as high, but, you know, they're doing some cool spins and variations and hitting the coping and doing some gnarly stuff that way, like, you know, this is where things from a subjective point of view become very difficult, because the end of the day, it's the observer's view of what they want to see is where the points come from. And that's the tough thing about competitions is the subjective nature of it is it makes it clinical and takes away the purity of the actual writing itself, which is why you had quite a bit of division, you know, especially with the street skaters, you know, the street guys, the park guys, the vert guys, you know, there was quite a bit of division that was created because you had guys that were incredible on the street but didn't do so well at the contest because, you know, they were gnarly skaters, don't get me wrong, but they couldn't conform to the box that the judges wanted for them to do well at the contest, so they wouldn't go to the contest. Yep. You know what I mean?
So skate photos and videos and the scene. Yeah,
100%.
It's almost a separate economy almost as well.
Yeah. It is, and it's – look, at the end of the day, the contest scene is different. It's a very, very different animal. It's – you got to know the game. You got to know the rules to play the game. And if you don't know the rules and you don't know how to play with them, then you're not going to do well at the game, and that's what it is. It is a game at the end of the day. It's not skating. It's not the purity of what you love, but it's a chance to get on a stage and it's a chance to earn money. Yep. So, you know, it offers a lot of – like that's a whole other tangent that I could talk about.
And it can, in one level, develop the sport by – and in another way, because of that, the pressure of competition conditions, at least for something,
but
where there is that athletic dimension. You're going to go, I'm going to try that spin because I've got to get it, you know, to get on the podium now, you know, in my second run.
That's right.
I'll see if I can unlock this one. Yeah.
Yeah. And look, for me, I don't mind competitions, but I know how to play the game. I learned how to play the game. But if you don't, then you don't do so well. So you're right. Going back to what you said, you've got to be balanced. You've got to be able to do all the, you've got to be able to, you know, air high. You got to be able to do your spin tricks. You got to be able to stylize your stuff. You got to hit the coping. You got to do the hard grinds. I just drew a limit, and I was lucky. I was very lucky. I used to do well as a protest. I rode how I wanted to ride, and I wasn't going to have anyone tell me otherwise. And I was very lucky that I didn't get too penalized for that. I used to do pretty well, considering that I didn't touch the coping that much. At the end of the day, like, you know, I used to medal and I used to podium quite regularly, but if you kind of broke down, I had plenty of tricks, don't get me wrong, and they were hard, but did I, you know, do a lot on the coping? Not so much. So, you know, it did let me down to a degree, but the judges in the end, they kind of understood what I was doing in a way, but, they just let me do what it was that I enjoyed. But that's a whole nother, animal. And I'll go back to, I'll do a little rewind and go back to the whole 98 thing and go back to the X Games. So, winning that X Games, doing well, set me up for a trip away, which Cessa, this is going back to Cessa basically, being the sole reason to, my success. And that, after winning that, that set me up and that gave him some collateral to go away because he saw a potential in my skating that I could take it, overseas and that I could do, compete on the international circuit. And he literally went to Rosas and he said to Rosas America, he goes, there's a guy in Australia, he just won the Australian X Games, he's doing, really well. I think he'd do amazing overseas. We got to get him over. And they're like, I don't know. We've got a pretty stacked schedule and we don't have a lot of money left. And Cesar was like, Italy said that it was okay for Shane to come over. They actually said it's all right. And Rosas America was like, well, are you sure? Because, there's not a lot of money in the budget at the moment. And he's like, no, he's doing really well. As I said, he won X Games. He's done well. You should send him over and see how he goes on the circuit and get him to do a couple of contests. And they were like, well, so long as Italy's okay with that. Now, bear in mind, this is where all the planets align, and I got very lucky. Italy goes on, we're talking about Roses Italy, they go on a hiatus every year. They have a break, and they have about a month or a month and a half off for their employees where everyone goes on a holiday. And at that very time is when CESA rung up the US. So US couldn't confirm with Italy, and because CESA was who he was, he was the top vert rider for Roses at the time. Is Roses America going to argue with CESA Mora? Hells no, they didn't. They literally took that on face value. And, yeah, they said, okay, cool, we'll give him a ticket. So I got a phone call at my place of work with CESA putting on a voice like he always used to do to me, asking, because I used to work at a place called Radio Parts, and it was basically like Dick Smith, except a little bit different. And he was trying to put on a voice and try and order a part number that we didn't have. Anyway, so it was quite embarrassing because I was trying to help the dude out and I had no idea what he was talking about. Needless to say, it was CESA playing a prank because he just loves to play pranks on people. And he mentioned that you've got to take some time off work. And I'm like, why? And he's like, you've got to go overseas. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you've got to go to a contest. Roses wants to send you away for two contests in the States to see how you do in a couple of contests overseas. And I'm like, okay, awesome. So I organized myself and got my time off work, which was the 2 weeks, and got my tickets, got myself sorted. Well, they kind of paid for the tickets and so forth and got myself over there. And it was a NIS contest in Venice Beach. NIS at the time, National Inline Skate Series, was open to everybody. Anyone could enter, pros and AMs alike. It was very laid back, and it was at Venice Beach. And I went to that contest and was up against not all the top riders, but, you know, a lot of solid riding crew were there, and, you know, a lot of sort of people like myself that was kind of coming out of nowhere or not quite on the top tier. And I did fairly well at that contest. Actually, it was Seattle, not Venice Beach. It was the Seattle contest. And then from Seattle, Mark Sanders was the Roses US team manager at the time, who met me in Seattle, picked me up at the airport and introduced himself and took me and Toby Heslop to compete at that weekend, which was pretty cool. I got to meet Bergeron that weekend, which was just amazing because that guy's just, when he was in his prime, he was just out of control. Holy moly. Yeah. From there, did well at that contest. So Mark was like, we're going to send you down to B3 down in Oceanside next weekend. We still got to work out some details because technically that's a pro contest and you're not allowed to compete at that. And I'm like, okay, I'm just here to do what I'm told. I'm not doing anything crazy. So anyway, he did some reeling and dealing, and I went down to Oceanside, and the organisers came up to me and said, look, you're an amateur. You're not a pro. You need to qualify. You're not supposed to be at this contest. However, as a favour to Roses, we're going to let you compete. However, there's no prize money. There's no points. You're just going to ride with the pros, and we're going to see how you do. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I've got no issues with that. So anyway, rode with the guys, got to meet the Engelhart brothers, which was awesome. Mark and Andre Engelhart, got to see Mike Budnick again. I think Bergeron was there, Toby, a whole bunch of other guys. I can't remember. My mind's a bit hazy, but once again, a top five finish. Which technically, because, you know, skated, rode, had an awesome time. I went up to the judges after and I go, I'm not placing here. But how would have I played? Would I have done all right? And they're like, yeah, you would have done about top five. And I'm like, oh. Yeah. And Mark Sanders just had this huge grin on his face, who was the team manager. And he's just kind of looking at me and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. But the only reason why I was allowed to compete there, which I didn't compete technically, was because Mark had pulled the strings. And then he said to me, he looked at me and he goes, all right, we need you for another 2 weeks. And I'm like, But I've got time. I've organised work. And he's like, no, we need you for another 2 weeks. We need to send you to Toronto for an ASA contest. And I'm like, okay. He's like, yeah, it's everyone's going to be there. And I'm like, oh, okay, excellent. So anyway, organised it with work. Went to work, rung him up and said, look, guys, I'm sorry, but I have to stay a bit longer. So anyway, I got into this contest, Toronto. Same deal. The guys come up to me. They're like, look, you're not a pro. We just want you to ride. We want to see how you do against all the top guys. See how you do. And same deal as before. And I'm like, yeah, that's not a problem. Just happy to be here. Happy to be riding. No troubles. Super cool. Anyway, so that contest, everybody, you know, whoever, you know, everybody was there. And it was a real, you know, Europeans, the Americans. It was a mind blow because it was just like, wow, this is just, I'm riding League. With the best of the best. Yeah. I'm just going to ride whatever's. And funnily enough, once again, a top five finish against the best of the best at that point. And yeah. I'm just, wow, okay, cool, stoked. Just everything kind of worked for me. I went up to same deal again, talked to the judges, and they're like, yeah, top five. You know, this is awesome. The organizer of the contest, Rick Bratman, came up to me and he said, under review, we're not going to send you to amateur worlds because you've clearly demonstrated your ability to compete on the world stage and compete against the best and not just, you know, not just do well, but you're top 10-ing. You're in the top five and you're doing well. So as a favour to Rosa's and so forth, we're going to make you a pro for next year. And I was just like, oh, that's pretty awesome. And then once again, Mark Sanders was big old smile on his face and he looked across, yeah, we're going to give you a contract for next year too. So you'll be riding pro. When you go home, you're going to have to, you know, probably work out the year because this was later on in the year because when I did that Toronto contest, it wasn't long after that. It was probably about two or three weeks and world championships for the ASA was happening in Vegas. And this was where they were kind of – Rosa's was hoping to get me to worlds, which I didn't really realize was going on. But there was no point. One, it would cost them more money, another 3 weeks of me in the States. And two, I didn't need to because they'd proven a point. Rosas was trying to prove a point to the ASA and the governing body that this guy was good enough to compete against the top guys. Yep. So they'd proven that point, and then ASA had come back and said, yeah, look, you know, everybody can save the hassle. We would have made you ride the amateurs to qualify as a pro, but clearly we're not going to do that because it's a waste of time and a waste of money, and you've demonstrated your ability. So – yeah, so once I got back to Australia, yeah, it was like Rhonda she laid it all on the table. She had the contracts basically ready to go for the next year. And this was like November. So I just worked up until I think middle of December and then I pulled the pin on work and then, you know, just started skating full time, which was just outrageous because that's all I wanted. That was all my focus was. Because I knew if I could get myself to being full-time and focus solely on skating, I could actually do something with it. But to get to that point was the hard part. That year leading up to that, and I can't brush over this, but that year where I left Tasmania and I came to the mainland was one of the toughest times because I was literally trying to skate full-time, working full-time, and just that was my life, work, skate. And I didn't have time for anything else and it wasn't enough time to skate, which is what I needed. And I identified that and I just tried to make it work. And luckily I had Cesar on my corner. He got me the trip away. I managed, who knows, you know, the planets aligned. You know, the good Heavenly Father was looking after me because I managed to make that trip work, and it did, and I got my chance, and I turned pro, and away we went.
That is amazing, hey, like that mix of, like, risk-taking, flat out hard work. And then, he's done that for a few people, Cesar, and that's just so great when you have great ones who use their kind of position of privilege to lift others up. It all came together for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's just, obviously there's luck, because even just how like an injury can come at the wrong moment and screw up your whole career, and so you were saved in that way too. Hey, like able to
miss a flight, like not even that drastic, like miss a flight or you know, something happened or whatever. Like,
yeah, the dude has a bad day and doesn't let you compete because you're not a pro, whatever, just because they're grumpy.
Yeah, yep, like all that these could have gone happen. 100%. That could have gone any number of ways in terms of, you know, being able to allow. It's just one, Cesar, you know, putting his neck on the line and, you know, twisting, you know, Mark Sanders' arm a bit to get me over there. And then, you know, actually performing, not getting. I honestly don't know how I managed to do it, you know, because there was a point that when I was riding, I didn't do that well at contests because the pressure was too much. And then I sat myself down one day and I just looked at – I kind of looked at what was going on, and I'm like, I can skate. I can clearly skate. Why aren't I doing these contests? What's happening?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm putting too much pressure on myself. I'm not having fun. And then I just had this epiphany, and I'm like, I'm going to go to the contest and have fun. Like, what am I doing? And as soon as I did that, that's where things changed. And then I started doing better at the contests, and then that just snowballed from there. So, yeah, look, it's, you know, trying to cast your mind back that far, being such an old fart that I am now, you know, it's trying to remember all the different pieces that sort of slotted together. But,
yeah,
you know, there was definitely moments there where, you know, taking a step back and trying to relearn things in terms of whether it's the game of the contest, how the business worked. Because, look, to be a pro, yeah, it's all fun and games and it's every Grommy's dream. Oh, I'd love to be pro. You know, it's if you want to be good and have longevity, and I'd say I got a pretty good life out of it in terms of longevity.
Yeah, sure.
You've got to be serious and you've got to treat it like a business. And if you don't, yeah, look, you can still have fun with it, but you just, yeah, you just, you got to be able to play the game as it's a bit of a.
Yeah, there's relationships thing I involved. Saying. Yeah.
And it is, you know, you do.
I'm thinking we've been going for quite a while, especially because it took us a while to get the tech going too. I'm wondering if you'd be up for like a second conversation in a couple of weeks where we do your 2000s so we can have a bit of luxury to do that, you know, in a similar kind of rambly way. Would you be up for that?
Yeah, man. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That way
yeah,
I can post this bit because this has all been so interesting and then we can still have a bit of our afternoon today. Can I just ask one more question though? What was your experience 100%, about?
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah, far away.
So, you get to the US, and was that, I'm guessing, probably the size or at least the width of these ramps is a whole new world. Did that take much of an adjustment, or was it actually easier to ride the competition ramps in the US when you were used to rustier, skinnier ramps in Australia? Yeah, was there any adjustment there where it took a while for you to kind of scale up to the kind of hardware you had to ride?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question, because at the time the ramps were very different from Australia to the US. And, yeah, 100% it took you – you had to adjust because it was very different. They were wider, bigger, smoother. Granted, these ramps were competition-style ramps, so they were, like, pristine. These ramps were pristine. Mm-hmm. They were amazing. They were immaculate. So from that point of view, they were easier to ride. However, you had to adjust. Now, something that I learnt from that trip away, that first time, was variation is the key to being able to ride vert well. And what I mean by that is, living in Melbourne, I didn't just ride the one ramp all the time. What I was doing is I was riding Paran, I was riding Vermont, I was riding the Shed. So I was riding three very different ramps at the time. And I was doing them on a regular basis. So because I was working, I could only ride at night, so during the week. So I'd go out to Cranbourne to ride. Then on a weekend, I'd either go to Paran, which was closer to me, or I'd trip out to Vermont and ride with the Vermont boys. Vermont was a better ramp, but it was just harder to get to. Now, because I was riding three ramps, when I went away, I was used to riding a variety of different things.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad to adjust, but you would spend the practice, you would spend the full two, you know, whatever, however long you were there for, you would spend that time getting used to the ramp so you can compete on it. It was quite different. And yeah, you would have to adjust. And then when you came home, it was very hard to adjust to what you were riding previously to go away, because everything was smaller, rougher, and in a lot of cases slicker and more narrow than what you were riding.
Yeah. So you're getting used to sort of like having the luxury of bigger carving to set up tricks. And I guess like a taller ramp allows you to do things a little more in slow motion as well in terms of rotations and flips. Yeah.
Slow. You can go higher. You've got more time to do stuff.
Yeah.
And it makes it safer in a lot of regards. But the other thing I noticed,
actually sticking on the surface with your wheels as well is
100%. The thing I'll say is what I noticed was I remember seeing this is a little bit in this story. I remember I used to skate with Ian Smith quite a bit, and I remember catching up with him in Belconnen in Canberra, because I lived in Canberra for a little bit when I first moved out of Tassie. And he'd just gone away and came back. And I remember seeing Ian before he went away and when he came back. And the improvement in his skating when he came back was just outrageous. It was just like, wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
It was just smoother, bigger, cleaner, more style, like everything. And it was just like, at that point in time, it was like kind of, I almost saw me and Ian sort of head to head in terms of our potential for, you know, becoming pro and going away. And it was like, okay, cool. He came back and it was like, whoa, how am I going to compete against that in my head? Then I got my chance to go away. And when you're under, you either rise to the pressure or you crumble because of it. If you rise to the pressure, it'll take you to a level that you cannot achieve where you are now. You get lifted up by everybody else because, you know, the level is just so much higher. So you change. And the riding that you do over there is, you know, that which makes you improve. Like, it's incredible. So when I came back, like, I kind of blew a lot of my friends and stuff away, because they were like it was like the same kind of thing, you know what I mean? Like, there was a transformation there. Because I was exposed to this new environment that was just so much higher than what I'd ever experienced before. So because of that, it dials you in. And then, awesome. And that's the launching pad. Once you get that launching pad, as I said, you either rise to it or you fall apart. And if you can rise, then away you go. You just get slingshotted forwards, which is what happened to me. I was just very lucky in that regards that I got that slingshot, and it just propelled me forward. So one, I came back home with this motivation that, you know, like I was a beacon on fire because I knew what I had to do. But I also had that down, I had this snowballing effect of, or all this momentum behind me of this improvement, and it just set me up for everything that went on after that. Yeah, it was pretty wild, man. Awesome. Like,
yeah,
wild.
Well, we're gonna pick that story back up. You got me fired up to go and put my skates on, so I'll go and do that.
Yeah, there you go. that's what it's all about, man. 100%. Speaking of which, how is your skating going?
Yeah, it looks slow and steady, you know, very different realm to you. And look, I mean, for me, maybe we can chat about this next time, because I'm always keen to pick brains on it. But for me, that the one that I'm just so slow in learning on is just building height in terms of vert skating. There's just that one vert bowl here, obviously the Rosny one. And getting the extra amplitude out of the top of the ramp is probably the biggest frustration point for me. I feel like in other things, like I'm getting comfortable with, you know, backflips and inverts and some of those things, but just height is one of the things. Before I'm too old to skate, I'd love to be able to, doesn't need to be super, super high, but I want to get higher in a vert ramp than I can ever get in a mini. Do you know what I mean? Like, to get beyond that.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Two things I'll quickly say. Do you travel much? Do you get onto the mainland much?
Only a little, yeah.
You got to let me know the next time you come over. We'll tee up a session because, yeah, if you can skate with someone and if someone can show you a few things, because it's very easy to tell you stuff, but there's a few things that can be shown to help things along in that regards. I forgot the other thing I was going to say. If I come down, if I come back to Tassie, which is not that often, but if I do, I'll try and make a trip down so I can have a look at what's going on and, yeah, hopefully, give you some pointers and stuff. Because funnily enough, airing, and I don't want to scare you, but airing is one of the hardest things you'll learn on ramp. Yeah. And we used to categorize this into basically lots of three. You know, getting off the lip is one thing. Like, that's awesome. Like, once you clear the lip, excellent, cool. Now you can start to work on the first 3 foot. So the next bracket is 3 foot. The next bracket after that is, like, 6 foot. The next bracket after that is, like, 9 foot. But to get to those levels is ridiculously hard. And
I can't get past about 1.5, 2 feet. Like, that's
yeah, man.
I can get to that and actually comfortably hold a grab, you know, a rocket or a mute or whatever, but can't get past that.
Mm. Yeah, it'll come down to something as, I won't say simple, but it's because it isn't. It's balance and timing. And the higher you go, the faster you go, which means you have to adjust your balance and timing to the height that you're traveling, which makes it that much harder because it changes. So because of that continual change of balance and timing, as you go higher, it just becomes harder and harder. And that's why we used to say the zones, because it's like that's when the zone changes. So then you've got to relearn what the balance and timing is for that next height of air. Otherwise, you don't go any higher. Yeah. Then once you sort that out, you go higher again. Then you've got to sort it out again.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you go higher again. Then when you start to do your tricks, you've got to figure out, all right, what is my balance and timing that I have to use for this height, for this
trick?
Getting
out of the grab. Yeah, well, the trick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it changes. Yeah. So then as you're riding so
I think I've got past jumping.
Tricks.
I think I'm riding up the wall. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I think part of it, I think for me, is like the psychological thing that I wonder if I'm almost pulling some of my momentum without even realizing I'm doing it. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm getting a bit scared about going too high. You know what I mean? Like
man.
My body's kind of,
And that's the thing. The higher you go, the scarier it is.
Yeah,
so then
yeah,
you have that issue. So, you're balancing all these little different things. But, look, it's really
– we'll have a tutorial sometime.
So much if you can be shown. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to give you some magical bit of advice, but there really isn't because, one, everybody is different and everybody's – you know, at a different stage.
That's dumb things to sabotage themselves as well, right?
Yeah. Habits and bad habits and all those kinds of things that need ironing out. And it's if you can get some experienced eyes to see what you're doing, it can really, really help with your riding. But it also helps you in person because, one, you've got the eyes looking at you. Two, they can instruct you as you go. And three, you've got the vibe of the session, which makes your skate that bit harder anyway. And if you've got a vibe of the session, that's what takes you. That's what, you know, one of the hardest things for me is I ride by myself a lot. I've got no one else to ride with. I used to hate doing it. It's one of the reasons why I stopped riding and I've gone on hiatuses is because I've got no one to ride with. If you've got no one to ride with, you miss the energy and you miss that little push to give you that little edge. And to ride well on half pipe, you need that. You need a session to happen for you to progress. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm not going to lie, it's almost impossible to progress when you're trying to skate by yourself like that.
Well, there you go. Well, we'll line it up sometime, mate. Yeah, look, I should go. And
no worries, mate.
Do my best in the meantime.
I can talk about this stuff all day long. So thanks a lot, man. Thanks for inviting me on your podcast.
Too.
Hopefully some of this made sense because I've got a tendency to ramble and go off on tangents.
No, you're a good storyteller. That's good.
I thank you for your time and I thank you for your consideration and for having me on, man.
Pleasure, Shane. And, I'll be in touch in the coming weeks and we'll get the second half of the story.
Hell yeah, man. Sounds good.
Catch you, dude. Bye.
Take it easy.
Mad Beef Rollerblading Podcast is produced by Mikey Lynch, theme music by Edifice Architect. You can subscribe to us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Stitcher and get in touch with us on our Facebook page. Mad Beef is supported by our growing number of Patreon patrons. To support the podcast, find us on Patreon, even just $2 a month. Every little bit helps.